and welcome to the Zesty Garden. It's the 10th of July, and I'm your host, Brian Earle. Today with me in studio is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we're going to have a lively conversation because you're joining us, and we have some great topics. And I hope that you'll call in with your questions or comments or go online. Our email address is zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can call us at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Diane, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's always a lot of fun, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, before I forget anything, I need to talk grasshoppers.
Yep.
Because
it's the time of year.
In the last week and a half, boy, they're sure invading again. Now, when I first moved into my home, I don't remember hardly any grasshoppers. I mean, there were a few, but the last 8 years, it's just been horde after horde every single year. So I must be helping to perpetuate the cycle somewhere in my garden. And so I'm looking at, I don't like spraying for them. There's just so many of them. So I want to talk about the Nolo bait.
Mm-hmm.
And if that bait is, I know once they get big enough, it doesn't really bother them at all.
Right. You have to treat them while they're fairly young. You know, your question about, you know, why have they been so bad the last 8 years or whatever it might be. I mean, there's no one simple answer to that, but there are some consistent factors that do play a role. And one of those we know is drought or good conditions for egg survival over the winter, because that's how grasshoppers and Mormon crickets survive, as eggs in the soil. So good conditions for that. It also could be just a function of the habitat around where you live that has changed somewhat or has become more conducive. Or once grasshoppers have become established, they're utilizing these unmanaged land, the land that doesn't get cultivated or doesn't have, you know, turf or sidewalk or asphalt over it, to take advantage of those as egg laying sites. And so now they're concentrated perhaps around your house or your neighborhood, whereas maybe before they were more dispersed. And so you weren't as, you know, you saw grasshoppers, but you didn't feel like there were hordes of them moving in. So, it, you know, there's many factors that can be involved, but certainly we know that climate, weather patterns, moisture, winter snow cover, soil cover in the winter. Those are all factors that definitely have an influence.
Now, I have a great neighbor who's got black plastic down that's about 10 feet wide and maybe about 30 to 40 feet long that he's used to plant. He's been growing his own Christmas trees. And now he's got some other fruit trees that are in this barrier fabric. Can the grasshoppers get underneath that, lay eggs, and be protected?
I would think if it's covered with that kind of landscape barrier fabric, it would not be a very attractive site for a grasshopper to lay eggs. Generally, what they like is undisturbed soil. And they particularly like soils that are a little bit lighter, so not a real heavy clay, you know, dense soil that's hard to get their ovipositor in.
This hasn't been tilled in a number of years, so it's probably not an area they'd want to go then.
Well, although that's when grasshoppers like soil that hasn't been tilled, but I haven't really looked at whether fabric or soil under landscape fabric could be a factor. So it would be interesting to go and look at it look under it a little bit in the spring. Do you see a lot of grasshoppers coming from there? I would think not. It's more generally like open land. And so our benches along the valley, the northern valleys, or well, any valley in Utah, every place people live pretty much is a valley. Those have been the prime, you know, kinds of habitat, you know, where you've got grasses, sagebrush, things like that, where it's not cultivated soil.
So let's go back to the Nolo bait.
Right.
So what's made up of in the bait? What's in it?
So Nolo stands for Nosema locusta, which is a pathogen, a naturally occurring pathogen of grasshoppers. And it's what's called a protozoan. So it has a resting stage. It's like a cyst type stage. And then when it's under the right conditions in the gut of a grasshopper, which is its host, it becomes active and then causes a disease in the grasshopper and ultimate mortality, death. And so the bait product that you purchase is a concentration of this Nosema locusta, this natural pasture. No, it's not cheap. And then it's mixed with a food bait for the grasshopper. So something that's going to get the grasshopper to attract it. And for the most part, it's bran. So, you know, like a wheat bran kind of product that the grasshopper will be attracted to eat. And then they ingest the Nosema locusta spores, these protozoan spores, and then it becomes active in the grasshopper. And why you have to treat early when you start to first see the young grasshoppers is that they need to consume the bait then, and it's not as fast acting as like an insecticide is. So it takes a little while for it to go through its development process inside of the grasshopper and for the grasshopper to die. When an adult grasshopper ingests it, it takes a lot more of the bait to kill it. Often adult grasshoppers aren't actually eating nearly as much as the young. When they're young, they're like the hungry teenagers we've talked about, where they're just very hungry all the time. They're eating lots of plant material, so they're ingesting that bait or any toxin that might be out there for them. Whereas when they're an adult, they're actually more focused on mating and a female reproduction, laying her eggs, and they don't do nearly as much feeding. And it's a lot harder to kill the adults. So you got to start early to get that population suppression going.
So how large is too large to worry about even putting it out?
Oh, once you see a lot of flying ones, it's kind of, you're kind of past the peak time.
So if I'm seeing them and they're more like no bigger than 3/4 of an inch, maybe 1/2 inch, that's still small enough?
Right. And if they're still, you know, hopping around eating a lot, that's the stage that you want to target. But again, it's not as fast acting as an insecticide. Yeah. So you have to put it out. Generally, we've seen it in a suburban area. It generally works best if you can use it as like a border around your property, especially if you are aware of where the grasshoppers tend to come from. If you've got some open land, you know, to one side of you, or even if you have neighbors between you and that open land, but you know they move from there across, you know, your neighbor's property and into yours, to use it as a border kind of treatment. But you will have to reapply it each time after you irrigate, after, you know, a rain event, anything that would break down that bait.
So if I'm seeing an area in my garden where they are, it's too late to affect them?
No,
is
I think you
located
could, yeah,
to put
I
it
would
in?
Okay. If you see them, you know, in your
I'm
garden.
I'm just wondering, okay, how much do I really want to do this? Because again, in the cost.
It is expensive. It's more expensive than an insecticide. So there are other kinds of baits for grasshoppers that have carbaryl, which is, many people know as the brand name 7, or one of the brand names, mixed with, again, this kind of bait product, a wheat bran or something else that attracts the grasshopper.
Do other insects eat it?
Not very many. It's fairly specific.
Okay.
So that's an advantage of the baits over like a broadcast spray, where you go out and spray 7 or spray malathion or something across a broad section of your garden, where you're being non-discriminatory. You're killing anything that's out there, including the lady beetles and other beneficial insects. There's one thing I wanted to pipe in though here that I found to be very successful for like garden types of plants, especially those that don't require active pollination at the time when you're protecting them, is just floating row cover. Covering up garden plants with floating row cover, using stones or bricks around the edges to secure it down. And that really keeps the grasshoppers off. They are not going to be ones to go up under something. They want to be in the open, and so they can hop away. That's their self-defense mechanism, or fly away if they're an adult. And so if you cover plants, even if it's fairly loosely covered, it'll deter most of the grasshoppers from feeding on them.
So, and I think we talked about this last year. I was going to do an experiment, and I'm just remembering now talking about this with my raspberries.
Right.
Because that's where I get so many of the grasshoppers coming in. So if I wait until, like I've got one row that's all the June-bearing type, and the berries are developing now, so it's past the time for the bees for pollination.
Right.
I could put something on that row and see what happens.
And I would guess you wouldn't even have to raspberries are fairly tall.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't even have to cover, you know, from ground to top the whole row. If you strung this fabric over the top and secured it on if you have any kind of posts or, you know, support posts or anything like that, just so that the top parts of the plants were covered where the majority of the berries are. I bet you would keep off a good proportion of the grasshoppers. Mm.
So they're flying to the plant or jumping to the plant rather than crawling up the stem.
Right. So the young don't fly yet, but they are great jumpers, as you know. That's why they're called hoppers, because they have those big back hind legs and they can really take off in a big jump. So, but, you know, you might get still some feeding right around the bottom of the plant. But if you're protecting the majority of it up at the top, I bet you would see some real benefit from that.
I was talking with a neighbor who's about a block and a half away. Her husband just turned 60, and there were several of us from the neighborhood meeting for some cheesecake last night. And all of us, as soon as the word grasshopper came up, oh, I've got a ton of grasshoppers. So hopefully this is something.
Yeah, so get on it fast. Don't wait until, you know, any later in the summer. This is usually late June to early July for the northern part of the state is kind of the prime time to
treat.
We're getting a little past that. You could still do it here in Cache Valley. I would suspect maybe further south you might be a little past when the no-low bait would have as much effectiveness.
And am I remembering correctly that grasshoppers are cannibalistic, and those that they find that are dead, they'll eat them, and they also ingest
protozoan? I mean, you will find grasshoppers eating other grasshoppers. They're herbivores for the most part, but sometimes they will take advantage of just some moisture that they can get from a colleague that's gone down, so to speak. But really the main way that the no-low bait spreads is that when it actually affects the behavior, interestingly, of the grasshopper. And when it's sick, it climbs high. It wants to be up high for whatever reason, that's a response that they have. But that's exactly what the protozoan it desires, because what happens then when the grasshopper dies, it becomes this source, this big husk that's filled with these protozoan spores. And then they actually kind of release out of the dead grasshopper when it dies and starts to dry up and open up. And it spreads the spores onto the leaves of the plant, surrounding plant and plants. And then more grasshoppers come along and eat those spores. So it's a mechanism of the protozoan to actually spread and propagate itself.
So I'll know I'm successful if I'm seeing a lot of little grasshoppers
just kind of hanging,
going up to the top.
You know, they're dead now, but they've like hung on and they become like these little like hard, crusty mummies, so to speak. But now they're spore factories, and that's exactly what you want.
Well, we're talking about all things insects today. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Diane Alston is USU's Extension Entomologist, and she's in here at the studio for about another 20 minutes. And again, 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So we got grasshoppers off the list. My next question, woolly aphids. Mm-hmm. So I've got, I've talked about this in the past. I've got a couple of beech trees, European beeches, mm-hmm. and one fernleaf beech. And each year the populations get just a little bit worse with the woolly aphids. And because they're woolly and they have that covering on them, I tried one year to put lady beetles on them and they just didn't stick around.
See the benefit. Huh?
Yeah. Hmm. So now I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to have to go
do
to
something.
DEFCON 5 and and do a soil drench so that the tree picks up whatever I'm drenching.
Yeah.
So my question is, what's the drench? What do I put down?
So a drench is usually the most popular way to treat pretty much any kind of aphid especially on a large shade tree. Because of the limitations of trying to get a spray on any kind of large tree and get good coverage. And those woolly aphids in particular, as you mentioned, have that waxy covering, and that helps protect them from, you know, sprays or anything that could land on them. And so for the homeowner, person trying to take care of their landscape trees, the primary product they're going to use is one that has the insecticide imidacloprid in it. And this comes in many different, it had been on patent for many years by Bayer Manufacturing. And so it was called Bayer Insect Tree and Shrub Control, Tree and Shrub Insect Control, got that backwards. But now it's off patent and there's many brands available. So you just need to look for that active ingredient called imidacloprid. IMI is how it starts. Now, that said, this is an insecticide that has been implicated for concerns on affecting pollinators. And so it's very important that you not treat a tree that's in bloom or before it's in bloom.
Like a linden. I think lindens and cache valley are in blossom right now.
Right,
so.
Right. And so
they tend to get a lot of aphids.
Because this imidacloprid is systemic. It is taken up by the roots of the tree and moved up into the foliage, which is the advantage for treating these aphids, where you can't reach them in these tall trees. But that's also the disadvantage for being expressed in the nectar of the flowers. And this is a very controversial topic. There is research and, you know, data and viewpoints of, you know, very well-known entomologists on both sides of this issue. Some saying that the data really doesn't support that it's a problem to pollinators if it's used properly. Others saying, oh, no, there is data to support that we see not outright bee kills in many cases, but just gradual declines in bee populations. It's hurting the reproductive output of bees, the survival of their offspring, you know, mini fat longevity, you know, what we call these sublethal effects. And in Europe, they've taken the step of the European Union has banned some of these, especially the seed treatment types of products where they treat crop seeds like canola or corn with this imidacloprid, and then it's expressed in the plant throughout its lifespan because of the concern about harming pollinators. So I don't want to make this sound like it's a cut and dried, you know, debate or answer. There's a lot of questions still out there and more research continuing.
But it sounds like why even if the research doesn't show one way or the other yet, why even tempt it? So just wait until the tree's not blossom. If you have a tree that blossoms, in my case, the beeches have never blossomed, and they're about, 12 feet tall, 15 feet tall. And so they're not too large yet. So I should be able to just do a quick drench.
There is an advantage in treating a little earlier in the season, the growing season, and that when the tree is really pushing growth, that's when it's actually taking up the most water or nutrients.
And so it's going to take a little longer.
So it's going to just take longer. So that is an advantage. And if you read the label of the package, you know, it'll often advise you to treat, in the late spring, early summer for this kind of reason. There are factors of why it can be advantageous to treat earlier, but I do think it's worthwhile to use caution in working with or using this group of insecticides called neonicotinoids. I just want to add one more comment about a way you could also get some beneficial effect on these woolly type of aphids is to use a horticultural mineral oil mixed with your insecticide if you decide to go that way, or just the horticultural mineral oil
if you're gonna
itself.
Spray it directly.
Right. You just go ahead and use that oil, like a 1% solution. It should not cause damage to the leaves of the tree at that low rate, and it will help break down that waxy covering on the aphids and suffocate them.
Okay. We're going to take a phone call. We have Carl in St. George. Hi, Carl. How can we help?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I have two questions. Number one, once in a while in the morning when we get up, there'll be a cockroach or a cricket or what. It's a brown bug about maybe a half inch long feelers, and they can really move. But once in a while, you'll just see them lying on their back with their legs like they're in the last throes of life. What are those things?
Well, I have to admit, I'm not certain.
That sounds like a cockroach.
I mean, I don't know about cockroaches laying on their back, though. That's not a behavior that they would exhibit. So it might take a little more description or a picture, a photo.
Can you send me a picture?
That's usually a great way to get to the answer rather than making several guesses that may be inaccurate.
Yeah. All right. Second question is this. Why can't there be a spray developed, or is there one, that when those are sprayed, it renders them impotent, and when they crawl back into the wall or wherever they go, that when they start breeding, they don't breed?
Well, actually, there are some sprays like that.
Why has that never been developed?
Yeah, there are some sprays like that. They're in the group of products that we call insect growth regulators. And there's many different kinds of insect growth regulators. Some affect the molting process where they shed their skin, but some actually do sterilize or reduce egg production in certain insects. And there are some actually that work on the group of cockroaches, and they're used in especially like by public housing and apartment dwelling kinds of urban facilities to take care of cockroaches, and they can be a very helpful tool. That said, they're not suitable for every insect, but there actually are some that can be used for cockroaches and some other groups of insects as well.
Where can you buy that?
So the trick, though, is generally those are not products that are targeted to the general public, so that you would find at your, Lowe's or Home Depot or, local independent gardening store. They tend to be targeted more to the pest control industry, where they can sell them in larger quantities. They're not toxic or anything. I mean, they're quite safe to use because they're very specific for insects, but they're generally not. They don't have the kinds of sales to package and sell them to the, the homeowner kind of market.
Okay. May I ask one more quick question?
Sure. Go ahead.
Where's the best place to spray for those? Around the outside of the home or inside specifically around the walls in certain rooms or where?
So are you seeing these inside your home?
Yeah, just one or two here every maybe 3 or 4 days.
So again, it kind of gets to the root of what the insect is and where it's living, what its biology is. And so I think we need to first identify what the insect is, and that will then, we can then give you a more specific answer. So would it be possible for you to email Brian a picture of the insect, and we can try to help you out with that?
How about if I just talk to the extension agent here in St. George?
Rick Heffelbauer may be familiar with what this insect is. I'm just not sure, because St. George is a very different environment from northern Utah. I know you do have cockroaches there, but it's not common for cockroaches to hang out in the open or lay on their back. They're very contact-loving insects. They want to stick to the baseboards and the hidey spots, and they come out at night. You don't tend to see them lazing about in the daytime, so that makes me suspect it's a different insect.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call, Carl. And if you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with Diane Alston and our gardening calendar and the rest of the Zesty Garden. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Zesty Garden. In our gardening calendar, the Logan Library Lunch and Learn Series is hosting today a basic garden design class by Hillary Halls, a landscape designer from Tony's Grove Garden Center, or whatever their new name is. I think they got bought out, so it's like Freckle Place or whatever. It's today at noon at the Logan Library. And for information, you can contact Logan, F-O-L, that stands for the Friends of the Library, at Outlook.com, or visit their Facebook page. The Stokes Nature Center in Logan is hosting a Backyard Harvest Habitat Gardens class Saturday, July 12th from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Liven up your garden with habitat plantings. Habitat gardens attract more bees, birds, and butterflies to benefit your plants and make your yard a more enjoyable place to spend some time. Participants will meet at the Logan Ranger District office. Information is at logannature.org. The Tahnequint Nature Center in St. George is hosting What's Eating You this Saturday. This workshop will go over what pests seem to be plaguing the county and what to do about it. So, Carl, sounds like a great place to go this Saturday.
Yeah, maybe take some of your insects in and get them identified.
All workshops are free and held at the Tahnequint Nature Center at 1851 South Dixie Drive. The USU Botanical Center Utah House is featuring Explore the Garden Family Night, Cooking from the Garden on Monday, July 28th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Learn how to cook and preserve what is growing in your garden. To register, go online at theutahhouse.org. And then the Wayne County Farmers Market is held Saturdays from 4 to 6:30 at 187 West Main Street in Torrey. The market runs through October. And I was just there, so I know that Sevier County has a gardener's market. It's in Joseph at Wildland Nursery, and it's in the morning. I can't remember the time. I know I was there like around
which time, noon-ish. Which day of the week?
It's on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was a great little market to be able to go there. A lot of different products. I had my first really good peach this season that had been brought up from St. George.
Oh,
so
sounds lovely.
So attend these gardener's markets. They're a great place to get fresh
There's
produce.
There's watermelons out of St. George now, too. Oh. I got one. Dan Dross brought one up. It was absolutely divine.
The one thing I love about growing in Cache Valley is the way that our cooler nighttime temperatures allow the plant to concentrate those sugars.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I don't like about gardening in Cache Valley is I want to get them a lot sooner.
Right.
So
we
it's
don't
great
get them
we
until
have these other places that we can get
the
them from. We're talking insects here at Utah Public Radio. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. And I wanted to talk about a topic, and it was appropriate that Tom Williams yesterday was talking about from one end to the other in the human body about how things work. And I had already decided I wanted to talk about this topic, but it's insect frass and how insects digest their food. So what got me thinking about this was the NPR was doing a story about how caterpillars munching on a plant trigger the plant to help protect itself and how they were measuring that. And I heard chewing sounds and I went, oh, that's a caterpillar eating something. And then they came on and said, well, this is a caterpillar eating something. Because I have monarch butterfly caterpillars, mm-hmm. and you can hear them when you put your ear to the top of the jar, you can hear them munching away.
And now, they weren't implying that the plants actually hear the caterpillar. They were
don't
implying
hear
that just,
them, but they respond
but
to them.
More of the bright. The cutting through the vibrations and cutting through the
exactly.
the plant material. Say, I never knew that plants had ears. That would be new to me.
Well, corn does. Anyway, yeah. So then I started thinking about the caterpillars and how they just eat a ton of vegetation. And with monarchs, what comes out the other end, it looks like this green bale of hay. And so I thought, okay, let's talk about insect frass and how it differs from one to the next.
Yeah, so right before the show, Brian and I were chatting about how a digestive tract of an insect differs from that of a human or other vertebrate. And in general, insects, as you might expect, have a much simpler digestive system. It's basically like a big tube that runs from their mouth to their anus. But that said, you know, there certainly are divisions in it and different processes occur. And, you know, areas where breakdown of the nutrient of the food materials occurs and the nutrients are absorbed. But I was also mentioning that the insects are very water conservation centric. So they want to extract a lot of the water out of their food because they don't drink like we do or vertebrates do. And they also don't produce urine. So their only waste product, for the most part, is frass, and that's their insect poop. And so it tends to be usually dry, although when you noticed about your monarch caterpillars, you're feeding them this very lush, you know, leaf material, and they're taking in a lot of water. And so their frass does tend to be a little bit wetter than, say, an insect that's feeding on a much drier food source, like a grasshopper feeding on a rangeland grass or a sagebrush plant. It can often be very, very dry. Cockroaches, we were talking about earlier, they're an example of an insect that produces a very, very dry frass because they just extract all the water out of it that they can so that they can fulfill the functions of their body. But one interesting comment about what the plants kind of, you'd think that, oh, this plant's getting munched by this caterpillar, you know, it has no chance to get back, so to speak, or protect itself. And actually, plants do have a lot of ways they protect themselves. And then one of the main ways is through the chemicals that are in their leaves and their fruits and their, you know, plant structures. And they use chemicals, first of all, to try to dissuade some insects from feeding on them. So you're aware of the kind of taste that cabbage or cucumbers, you know, different kind of plant groups, or tomatoes, solanaceous plants have. And a lot of those chemicals are explicitly there to try to ward off some herbivores from eating them. But there's still obviously those that do. But then these chemicals get processed through the digestive tract of the insect and come out in the frass. And there are parasitoids in particular, sometimes predators, but most examples we know of are parasitoids. These are little wasps that come along to parasitize the caterpillar or other insect. And they actually can pick up on these chemical odors that come out in the frass and say, aha, that's the caterpillar that I know is a good host for my eggs. And they can help find it in your garden based on these chemicals that are coming out of the frass that the insect, the parasitoid wasp, picks up on.
That's fascinating how that's developed.
So aren't those plants pretty smart?
Like, okay, well, you're munching me now, but I'm going to take care of you a little bit later. Of course, and when I look around naturally here, plants like the box elder tree, when they have the generations of the caterpillar that just munch them, well, they just put out new leaves. They've developed ways of doing that. But when we're growing a garden and we're bringing plants in that are not native to the area, they don't have the same defenses as much.
Another good example of that refoliating is, if for those that drive through Sardine Canyon between Wellsville and Brigham City, you may have noticed a lot of defoliation of the maples through there. And that's the forest tent caterpillar. And the same thing happens. If the trees are relatively healthy, they can put out a whole new flush of leaves after they get defoliated by this caterpillar, and you would never know later in the summer that this had happened. I do notice some of the trees looking a little stressed, and so I'm going to be watching that, and I'm wondering if some of those are perhaps not going to be able to put out that full second flush of leaves, and we might lose some of those. And that's what happens, like in drought periods, times when they don't have enough water to meet all their needs.
Well, and we had a lot of moisture, at least toward the end of the winter season here.
Right.
So I can't imagine what it must be like for southwestern or southeastern Utah, where they were way below.
And this is also relates to like bark beetles. That's another prime example. When you have droughty conditions and the forest trees are very short on water, their sap is very concentrated, which the beetles love and attracts them to come and attack the trees. But they don't have enough pitch, their sap moving in their tissues, to be able to push those beetles out when they start to invade the tree. And so they succumb and the beetles win and the tree loses, so to speak.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com. And I have a question. This is from Hillary, and it's going back to our earlier question about doing the soil drenching and aphids. She says, well, how about spraying with soapy water? Especially
certainly
with those woolly aphids.
Right, certainly. Soapy water will work too. I think the main kind of point I was trying to make of where the drench can have the real advantage was when you've got these large trees. It's hard to reach any kind of, you know, limb above, 7-8 feet very effectively with your sprayer. Most sprayers that people can, you know, the pump-up sprayer that people might have around the home. So that's the difficulty.
What about me just taking the nozzle that I use to clean the driveway, and since my trees are only about 10 feet tall, to just go up underneath them and shake them out?
Yeah, any kind of physical removal action you can have is helpful.
Okay, so we have about 90 seconds left, and we have Darlene in Logan. Hi, Darlene. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I had a question for your guest. We have mountain ash trees and aspen trees in our yard, and suddenly they are weeping this sappy stuff, and their leaves are falling off. And someone told me there's a Chinese insect infestation of ash and aspen this year. Is there anything I can do about it?
There are some invasive insects. I don't think that's what's happening with your trees. It could be that you have some borers in the trunk of the aspen, and that's causing the weeping, or you could have aphids on the leaves, and that's causing a sticky honeydew. Those would be the types of things I think would be more likely.
So she could do a soil drench with those trees.
If that's, you know, if those were the problem, I would get it diagnosed a little more accurately by taking a sample into the Cache County Extension Office and trying to get it identified.
All right. How do I take a sample? Just take some leaves in?
Yes, wherever you're seeing the symptoms of what's going on. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Great.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Darlene.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. And we've reached the end of our time. It always goes,
so
quick.
So fast.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, has been my guest, and we'll be back again next month. Thanks, Diane.
All right. Take care.
And coming up next, you're going to learn about don't plant that plant. It's called vinca. It seems like everyone grows it, but you may want to reconsider. Welcome to the Wait, Don't Plant That segment. Today with me in studio is Jerry Goodspeed. He's USU's horticulture extension agent. And our topic for today is vinca, also known as periwinkle. Describe for me, what is vinca?
Vinca or periwinkle is another ground cover, and it's usually used in shade to part shade locations to cover the ground. It has a little purple flower on it, color of periwinkle. That's how it gets its name. And it can be a little bit aggressive. Okay, it can be a lot bit aggressive at times, but that's mostly what it's used for, as a ground cover.
Now, there's more than just purple varieties, aren't there?
There are some whites out there as well.
Are there any yellows?
Not that I'm familiar with.
Okay.
That doesn't mean they're not. That just means I'm not familiar with them.
And people are normally planting this
as a ground cover to fill in underneath plants. And one of the problems with periwinkle, I have a neighbor that has planted it. I have a fence between my house and his house, and yet the periwinkle keeps encroaching upon my peach trees and my garden and my lawn. And every year I have more periwinkle than I know what to do with, and so I spray it out and I try to kill it. But that is one thing about periwinkle, is it has a tendency to just keep growing and growing and moving along, and it wants to create a path probably around the earth, I would guess, the way it grows.
So it's not quite as bad as kudzu in the south, but
nope,
it's
not quite as bad as kudzu. It won't. Well, I say that. However, I have seen it, cover toys, swing sets, not climb up and over the swing set, but just cover the base of it really good.
So it looks nice and green.
Yes, it does.
Does it need to have extra water, or can you use this if you've got a drought tolerant?
It does best with some extra water, Brian. Yeah,
okay.
It does a lot better. And maybe that's the way to control it. We'll put it into places where there's no water and hope it doesn't grow.
Okay, I'll let you try it out that way. How does it grow? Is it underground?
Yes, it does have
seed at all.
It's what we call rhizomes, those underground stems that'll grow and will sprout up, and it just keeps moving. And I have seen it move into lawns. I've seen it move into flower beds. Obviously, at my house, it moves into gardens. It's moved into my raspberries, which is really hard then to get it out of the raspberries. And that's one of the problems with it. Keep it away from other perennials, because once it's moved into them, it's really hard to get out of them.
Once the vine starts climbing over, will it root from the stem?
Yeah, it can. It can root from about anything. I've decided that it can even kind of just look off in the distance and start to grow spontaneously.
It can project itself into the neighbor's yard.
Yeah, what's that with a Star Trek? What is that where you can just move yourself somewhere? Yeah, that's what it feels like to me sometimes.
So if you want to have a really good ground cover, what would you, this is so readily available, what would you use in its place? That's going to give you nice purple flowers and cover up the other weeds.
I'm not sure that there is a really good replacement. That's part of the problem, is that most of our ground covers for a reason, because they're aggressive and they take over. And vinca is no different. Just make sure you have a nice edge, a deep edge into the ground where the roots can't go under, and then keep it edged with an edger if it's along the lawn or anything like that, so that it stays in its place. And that's mostly what I recommend, is if you like it, plant it, but understand it can move, and so make sure that you have a way of keeping it where it should be.
Now, unlike bishop's weed, which I've seen coming up into lawn, vinca doesn't typically come up into the lawn, or maybe you've
seen it? Oh, it can.
Okay.
Yeah, I have seen it in the lawns. Now, it doesn't like to be mowed, but it can. It can move into lawns as well. It's not quite as aggressive as bishop's weed or some of the other ground covers, but yeah. On occasion, it can start to cause problems.
What about a ground cover like plumbago?
I like plumbago. It's also, again, rhizomonous, where it'll just start growing, but it is not near as aggressive. It doesn't grow near as fast.
Okay.
So we like plants like that we can kind of control, and every year cut them back a little bit, as opposed to a vinca, a bishop's weed, some of the other ones that we'll talk about. They're just so aggressive that they can move you know, a quarter of a mile in 10 minutes. That's what it feels like. You cut them back and you go back out there the next day and you think, I just cut you back. And yet you're right back where you were. And so those are the ones that we worry about. The ones that are slow movers, well, that's kind of that's what plants do. They grow. Either they grow or die.
And plumbago is nice because you can, you don't have to water it quite as much.
I mean, yeah, we use it as in a lot of our dry locations. I really like plumbago, and it's also a part shade, a full shade type of a plant. Full sun, it doesn't do quite as well, but it can even grow there.
So I've just turned this into the wait, don't plant that, but plant this segment.
But this is a better plant.
All right, thanks, Jerry, for coming in.
You bet.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Oh, my love's like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. Oh, my love's like a melody that's sweetly played in tune. That's the beginning of a poem by Robert Burns celebrating the rose or celebrating his love. The history of the rose is one of the best traced histories of flowers, and yet still what we know of the origins of the rose remains almost lost to time as effects of the Trojan War. As early as the 12th century BC, the Persians and the Medes carved representations of the typical five-petaled single form of the flower as a religious emblem. If we put aside geological evidence, which indicates that roses were flourishing in some form long before our species made its appearance, then this is the earliest knowledge of the flower. I am using, as I talk about roses, and I had hoped to do this in June because for some reason, maybe because of brides in June, roses are associated with June. And I had hoped to talk about the rose while June was still with us. And here we are in July. But I'll draw a little from a book by Wayne Winterud on roses, A Celebration. And in it, he says that there are several things that make the rose distinctive. First, its geographic distribution is remarkably broad. Though there are no roses native to South America, Australia, or New Zealand, the dispersal of the genus extends through the northern hemisphere from China and Japan through Siberia down to the Himalayas and south to the Philippines. It continues from North Africa into northern Europe and across the Atlantic to continental North America down to Mexico. The climactic range of the genus is enormous, stretching almost from Arctic conditions to the mildest temperate zones. Such diversity reflects genetic material that is unusually capable of survival and adaptation to a wide and ever-changing range of climactic conditions, a heritage that comes to matter hugely in the dispersal of rose species and hybrids throughout the world. Another thing about the rose is that it has fascinated artists. There have been a number of artists who have created folios, paintings of roses. The most famous is Joseph Redoté, with his publication in four volumes containing 170 plates. I remember as a kid I received facsimiles of the plates in a coloring book and had fun working with that. The other remarkable fact about the genus Rosa, no other in the entire botanical kingdom reflects so long, so persistent, so devoted an intervention by man. Written records of the cultivation of roses extend back more than 5,000 years to the present. But there is ample, though unwritten, evidence of an even longer history, particularly in China and the ancient Middle East. The late Middle Ages practiced its own version of aromatherapy, equating pungency with efficaciousness in the treatment of disease. So the strong fragrance of some rose petals, when harvested and dried, was judged both helpful and delightful. no dichotomy in the world where malodorousness of poor sanitation and occurrence of ill health went hand in hand. Huge numbers of plants were cultivated from the 13th to the 19th century southeast of Paris, and their petals were harvested and processed into paste, oils, unguents, producing a veritable pharmacopoeia of remedies for all human surface ailments, including damaged skin, ulcers, wounds, amputations, eye injury, and disease. As a maker of potpourri myself, I discovered early on that in the breeding of roses, the form and the color have been prominent, and so the scent of roses has been neglected. And so if you buy a florist rose, or this used to be true, it likely doesn't have a rose scent. So I had to order David Austin English roses that indicate how well-scented they are and how perfect for potpourri. The other thing that we really should consider when thinking about roses is that no flower has achieved anything near the prominence of the rose in human imagination, not as a real flower, but as an idea. From 12th century Persian carvings onward, it was employed as a religious symbol. In the earliest Greek religious history, it was associated with Aphrodite and came to represent youthful purity. Later, to the Romans, it was the flower of Venus and also of Bacchus, a symbol for luxury and indulgence. The white rose became associated with the purity of the Virgin Mary, and by extension, the red rose with Christ's passion. By the Renaissance, the rose had again been associated with the beauties and pleasures of the world, showering Botticelli's newborn Venus with petals and showing up in Baroque and even classical periods as a bouquet clasped by a leering Bacchus. The interesting thing about human symbols is that they take on a life of their own, gaining strength with each expression and sometimes becoming far distant from, or at least something other than, the thing they originally represented. The stylized acanthus leaves on Corinthian columns, for example, are instantly familiar to us, having been employed as architectural decoration for more than 3,000 years. Michael Pollan, in his chapter on roses in Second Nature, assembles this litany: the war of the roses, a crown of thorns, the rosy-fingered dawn, sub rosa, a rose is a rose is a rose, the rosary, Rosicrucians, the romance of the rose, the rose bowl, a bed of roses, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet, Dante's yellow rose of paradise, when the fire and the rose are one, run for the roses. Toward the door we never opened into the rose garden, rose-colored glasses, rosebud, Tennyson's white rose of virginity. And I think also of Blake's Sick Rose, this poem of his. O rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. And Michael Pollan concludes that the rose as a symbol seems almost a symbol of symbols. Of all the wildflowers and flowers cultivated since antiquity in China, Greece, and the Orient, it is the rose that has the richest symbolism. The white rose represents purity and innocence, the red, passion and bloodshed, sensuality as well as martyrdom. The tiny bud with its tightly furled petals soon opens out into the velvety, languid richness of the full-blown flower, an allegory for the passage from innocence to maturity. In Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's Little Prince, the little prince defends the roses who were accused of having thorns out of pure malice, and he exclaimed, "Oh no, flowers are weak, they are naive, they comfort themselves as best they can, they think themselves very dangerous with their thorns." And in a book called Green Thoughts by Eleanor Perenyi, she's a Hungarian gardener and writer, she tells about the history of the peace rose. Peace has a romantic story. It was bred by a distinguished house of Meland in 1939 when Francis Meland discovered in his nursery a ravishing rose growing from a single seed he had planted. He knew he had something extraordinary. The beginning of the war kept him from finding out exactly what. All he could do was ship unnamed and largely untested cuttings in all directions, hoping that one or another of them would safely arrive. Those consigned to the American grower Robert Pyle in Pennsylvania were aboard the last plane to leave France in November 1940, a step ahead of the Nazi armies. The Melans waited for 4 years to learn its fate. In August 1944, when a letter arrived from Pyle. Whilst dictating this letter, he wrote, "My eyes are fixed in fascinated admiration on a glorious rose, its pale gold, cream, and ivory petals blended to a lightly ruffled edge of delicate carmine. There it is before me, full of promise, and I am convinced it will be the greatest rose of the century." He was right. Peace was skillfully promoted. On the day Berlin fell, it was given its name in a ceremony in California, attended by rose lovers from all over the country, in which doves were set free. When the delegates to a San Francisco conference arrived in their hotel room, each found a vase containing a single specimen and a message from the American Rose Society conveying wishes for peace and goodwill. Peace deserved its acclaim as an archetypal modern rose. The pity is that it should also have archetypal modern faults. Beautiful though it is, it has no scent, and while it is fairly hardy, it is susceptible to every rose plague in the book. It was bred for looks alone, and that, by and large, has been the aim of all modern breeders. Well, there are many things to be said about the rose, but I'll conclude with this, and thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.